Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Copernic Global Investors third quarter 2021 conference call. As a reminder, today's call is being recorded. At the conclusion of today's presentation, there will be a question and answer session. Instructions will be given at that time. At this time, I would like to turn the call over to Mr. Kasim Ghaffar. Please go ahead, Mr. Ghaffar.
Thank you, operator, and welcome to the third quarter 2021 conference call. My name is Kasim Ghaffar, and I have with me David Iben, our CIO and portfolio manager for the Copernic Global All Cap Strategy and Copium for the International Strategy, and also Alisa Cochran, our Director of Research and Analyst. Before I pass the call to Dave and Alisa, I'll be providing a quick firm update. Copernic ended the third quarter with overall firm assets of roughly $7 billion. This was a nice increase in the beginning of the year when our AUM was right around $5.2 billion. This increase was due to strong inflows and market appreciation from our portfolios that have historically and even currently tended to perform well in the market environment. Moving along on the personnel side, no changes to report, and we ended the quarter being 43 employees strong and have continued to be stable with minimal turnover since inception of the firm. That brings us to an end to the business update. Please note Dave and Alisa will be referring to the presentation, which can be found on our website, copernicglobal.com, under the News and View section. Also, we do have some new content, including Dave's most recent letter. We encourage everyone to have a look after this call or at your convenience. And with that, I'll pass it over to Dave and Alisa. Dave, please go ahead.
All right, thanks, Kasim, and thanks to everybody for joining us. Another exciting quarter. The market seems to like to go up, which works pretty well. Anyhow, a lot to talk about. This is a continuation of, I guess I can call our desert series. Over the summer, we wrote about 29 palms in Sedona, and now this, I guess after spending a few days in Marrakesh, desert's on the mind, but at any rate, we've been using the desert to talk about such things as scarcity and the value of scarcity, to talk about in this new era we're living in, how to distinguish reality from mirages, talking about how inflation migrates through the system, and we talk migration as opposed to transitory is what we're told it's doing, but it does seem to migrate, and the resultant opportunities from that as investors. Today, as the picture shows, we're using the desert to talk about really hardiness, I guess, fragility. Nassim Taleb talks about in his book, when you try to protect people and companies and society in general from any of the afflictions that the natural laws of the universe put on them, you maybe have good intentions, but it usually leads to making people and things and systems more fragile. So that seems to be what happens. And so as the world's central banks and governments are all creating a fragile world, then more than ever, we believe what we've always believed, and as David Swenson puts better than we do, this is the time to look different than the crowd. As he puts it, superior results require unorthodox and rational asset class allocation, unconventional and timely commitments to out-of-favor asset classes. Certainly will show that in-favor asset classes are not a place people should be looking or risky anyhow. Howard Marks puts it to, you have to think differently. This is definitely a time to think differently than the crowd. In a fragile environment, people should be looking to build a portfolio of anti-fragile companies and securities. So that's what we hope to talk about. We will start with the concept that should we assume that things are fragile? We would suggest anybody pay attention to the buildup of debt in the U.S. and everywhere else in the world. Rather scary. 350% of GDP, that's an impressive number. Debt, as they say, at best case, is borrowing from the future. course, in conjunction with this, the central banks of the world have been printing a whole lot of money. Now, we're talking almost a tenfold increase in the money supply in the last couple of decades. Tenfold. So in theory, the dollar should have lost 90% of its purchasing power, and certainly there's no shortages of things that now cost 10 times as many dollars as they did 20 years ago. To put the stock market in perspective, the economy, of course, is a rough estimate of what sales are. These sales must then cover all the expenses, all the goods, all the services, all the materials, all the labor, the interest cost, the taxes to the government. What's left over is the profits and support valuations. So it's not that often you see stock markets become bigger than the economy in which they're in. It usually doesn't end bad. So the U.S. market, it is bigger than the U.S. economy. Shockingly, it's bigger than the U.S. economy, plus China, Japan, Germany, and the U.K.'s economy. So really breathtaking. Within the stock market, when you get these manic periods like now, when there's too much money chasing stocks, not only do stocks get expensive, but the popular ones, the really expensive ones, become outrageous. You can see from this diagram that 1999 was a wonderful time to sell the popular stocks and look for shelter, buy something better. Certainly people that owned expensive stocks in 99 wished they hadn't a few years later. It was a painful 80-something percent drop in the NASDAQ and a 90-something percent drop for many of the growth funds. This chart suggests that this might make 1999 look not so bad in perspective. Definitely people are paying for stocks they like. So if that's the case, if we're in an environment where stocks are really expensive, especially popular stocks and high-grade real estate and art and you name it, anything with a good story is expensive and likely fragile, we need to start talking about how do we have an anti-fragile portfolio. And to discuss that more, let's hand it over to our director of research, Lisa Corcoran.
Thanks, Dave. Yeah, as Dave showed, the high valuations in stocks and bonds, the high levels of debt, 40 years of interest rates falling have made the market's bones very brittle. So how do we construct a portfolio that can protect us from this? And so we suggest an anti-fragile portfolio. And so what is that? Well, a fragile portfolio is one that has a small amount of upside with large amounts of downside, and it's one that is hurt by disorder. It will not do well if the system changes. An anti-fragile is the opposite, and it can handle change. It is one that has large amounts of upside with very small amounts of downside, and it is one that benefits from increased volatility, benefits from disorder, takes advantage of the inefficiencies caused by easy money policies, low interest rates that have incentivized a lot of malinvestment. You're benefiting from misperceptions that volatility is risk. And a portfolio that would benefit from investors' tendency to project the history well into the future. Things that worked in the past, people are believing are going to work in the future, as Dave's charts have shown. So how do we build an anti-fragile portfolio? Well, we start with what you shouldn't own, which is the popular stocks, which are extremely expensive these days. Also, avoiding these low-paying financials. Many of the bonds are yielding negative returns at right now. The prices are so high. We do suggest that investors own option value and tangible value. And to take a tangent on optionality and explain it using a simple example with the weather, if someone were to come into our office in Tampa and ask whether or not we wanted to make a bet that it will rain 6 inches in a month, is this a good bet or a bad bet? this is the historical monthly precipitation for Tampa. So we've just survived, it's October, we've just survived the rainy summer, and we're sitting here in October. This would be a bad bet if we said it will rain 6 inches tomorrow, or next week, or 1 month from now, even 6 months from now. However, given enough time, if we can last a year, this is actually something that is a very promising bet. And it looks even more promising if we had, say, 5 years. So the takeaway is that with time, an option suddenly becomes very valuable, because an option pays when something happens. So the more time that you have, the more valuable that option becomes. So with the weather, as an example, you had something that was highly unlikely to happen, suddenly becomes highly probable given time. And this chart is just a visual representation of that. This is the value of an option over time. And as you can see, with time, the option value is exponentially higher. This is why it is so important for investors to have a long-term view and be patient. And also, you know, because in the long run, things are more likely to reach their intrinsic value. We have no insight as to how things are going to move in the short term, but over the long term, fundamentals will play out. Also, with an option, your downside is limited, while the upside potential is very large. So by definition, an option is an anti-fragile investment. This seems obvious, but if we want to seek convexity, we also want to avoid concavity, which are investments that have small amounts of upside with potentially large amounts of downside. Today, however, the market seems to love concavity. It's a good example of a low-interest bond. Today, you can buy a 30-year bond and get 2% return, which is returning, in real terms, a negative return. And if interest rates rose to 5%, or 10%, you're losing 50 to 75% of your money. So many investors are lulled into the projection bias. They think, well, interest rates have been dropping for 40 years. It's hard for them to see things changing. So concave investments, fragile investments, do not do well with change, as this would show. You do want to seek convexity in a fragile system. And in our opinion, the best convexity we can find in the market are in gold and gold mining stocks. Many of these stocks are trading 70 to 90% off of what their intrinsic value is. And the downside is limited. Many of these companies are trading below their liquidation prices, even using current gold prices. The downside's limited, and when you're buying a company, a mining company that has a huge reserve and resources that will allow them to mine for many decades, you're effectively buying a non-decaying option. So time is on our side with that. Now, if the gold price rises, suddenly these stocks are going to be worth multiples. So just like with the weather, we have to evaluate how likely it is that the gold price will rise. And fundamentals suggest that gold should rise materially from today's price. It's highly correlated to the monetary base, but as you can see from this chart, there are times when the gold price gets out of sync from the monetary base. In the 1980s, the gold got ahead of itself and was ahead of the monetary base. However, today, the gold price has been lagging for quite a long time. When investors hear there are upside of 300 to 1,000%, naturally the question would be, why does this opportunity exist? Why is the market mispricing the gold optionality in these stocks? And from our standpoint, we believe we're very different from most investors in how we think about time. most investors in the industry value gold stocks using a discounted cash flow model, which says that if I have to wait a year before I get my cash, I want 7% more or 5% more. Another way to phrase this would be that next year's cash is 7% less, worth 7% less. So this makes sense for fiat currencies because they have devalued over time. However, does this make sense for gold? If I were to receive a $100 bill today, in 10 years, it's highly unlikely that that maintains its purchasing power. However, if I were to receive a gold ounce today, in 10 years, it's highly likely that it will have preserved its purchasing power. Gold has been proven to be a store of value for thousands and thousands of years. So by using a discounted cash flow model, we're saying that gold mined today is worth roughly twice as much as gold mined 10 years from now. To us, that doesn't make sense. We believe that DCF models are flawed when you're dealing with an underpriced good and dealing with gold, which is shown to store its value. So this is quite a difference in the value of a gold ounce that is mined. Who's correct? A DCF model has served investors well in an environment that's seen disinflation and has seen falling interest rates, but this cannot go on forever. And we like it when we're different from the crowd. This is how you, when logic is on our side, which we believe it is, this is how investors make money. And we should point out that we like optionality. However, with the gold stocks priced where they are, we're getting free optionality. Many of these companies, as I mentioned, are trading below their liquidation values, just leaving gold price where it is. So we believe that with a rise in the gold price, many of these companies are worth much more. And to show our theory play out in real life, I will pass it back over to Dave.
All right. Thank you. Can we apologize for all the math? Looks like we didn't lose anybody. But no more math, but we figured it was important. We think the distinction between how things might be valued and how they are valued right now by the masses is really the thing that matters most right now. If you look when I started this business 4 decades ago, it couldn't have been more different than now. And what a great time to be buying bonds and buying stocks and using DCF models to do that, because what we've seen since then are 4 straight decades of falling interest rates, relative stability, relative disinflation. It's gone from one extreme in terms of high real interest rates to another extreme to negative real interest rates. So what's worked the last 40 years? Arguably, it's the last thing you're going to want to own now, and we'll explore that a little bit. But bonds went from such a great deal when they were yielding 15% to now, as Jim Grant from Grant's Interest Rate Observer calls them, they are return-free risk. We think that's right. Options, on the other hand, especially when you can buy them on tangible assets that are non-decaying, seem like the opposite. They could arguably be called prospective large returns without the risks, sort of the opposite. But we've discussed the logic of why optionality is important and why the DCF might not be as good as it once. But let's look at empirical data. We'll look at some recent data, and we'll look at some history from the 60s and 70s. So uranium producers, we've been talking to you about them for a number of years now. Patience finally paid off. It just didn't go up and didn't go up, but finally it did. But if you owned uranium over the last year and a half, you've made roughly 60%. Not a bad return. If you own the producers that are selling uranium and benefiting from that 60% run, you did better. But these companies also hold optionality. They have a lot of uranium they won't be producing for a number of years, so they have optionality. And so instead of making 60% holding uranium, you could have made 300% by owning the two large, well-regarded uranium producers. If somebody wanted more optionality, said, let's buy the guys that have a lot of uranium but aren't going to produce this year or next year and probably not the year after, the optionality paid off. Instead of making 60% or even the 300% of the majors, these things are up 600 to 800%. So optionality paid off. We'll spare you the slides from the natural gas companies and the copper companies and the oil companies, but it's the same thing. The one with large reserves to be mined or produced in the future did much, much better. The optionality paid off. Interesting to us is that while all these things were paying off, the price of gold has gone down for the last five quarters. That's a wonderful thing. So you've had money supply going up, meaning the theoretical value of gold has gone up, but gold hasn't really kept pace. So if somebody could own gold, they have this the likelihood that gold goes way higher in the future. But if somebody wants real optionality, they can go for the smaller companies that own a lot of gold that won't be pulled out of the ground this year. It will be 5 years from now, 10 years from now. These are the ones that did really well 12 years ago, did really well in 2016, did well a year and a half ago when things started to run, but now are priced very inexpensively. So if you're looking for optionality, you want something that's way mispriced, way undervalued, and is selling at a low point in the market right now, seems like an interesting place to be. That's our favorite, but lots of things, most anything out there over time should keep up with this money supply you see here. You know, as they say, inflation, you know, anywhere always is a monetary phenomena. Money supply is up 9 or 10 fold. The NASDAQ's up 9 or 10 fold over the last decade or so. S&P's close. Prime real estate's done that sort of thing. Arts have done that. And as we've talked about in recent things, we won't go through it again, it migrates. So look for optionality in the places it's likely to migrate to, commodities being an obvious. In the 60s, they printed a lot of money. They called it guns and butter. Let's have the government pay for the military and pay for a lot of social programs. And 10 years later, the inflation kicked in, and look at the price of the commodities index with a lag. Then things were pretty stable for quite a while, but the late 60s, you had that tech mania, and the Fed printed a lot of money for every little crisis that came along, massive amount of money. And you can see with a lag, 5 to 10 years later, big boom in commodities. Since then, things have pretty much settled down. Now we've just printed $4 trillion in the last month and a half, a year and a half. The last year and a half, we printed more money than had been printed previously through all of history. History and logic would suggest that the next five to 10 years could see quite a move in commodities. Not that it's going to happen, but it's likely to happen. And once again, if we can buy these convex options, these things where we lose very little if we're wrong and make a whole lot if we're right, commodities are an obvious place to look. We've talked a lot in recent calls about Richard Cantillon and the idea that money's not neutral. Sure, it migrates to the system, but not evenly. It takes its time and it goes into different things, into what and when. Clearly, things that are scarce and valuable are better things to own than things that aren't. And as to when, we just showed you some charts on commodities in general, but really quickly here, we will take you through some history, the same history we were showing, but commodity by commodity. In the 1970s, in response to that 1960s money printing, gold went from $35 an ounce to $660 an ounce with a brief stop at $800. Oil, this went from $3 a barrel to $36 a barrel. Fascinating move, natural gas, as you can see, kept pace. Food's the same thing. Beverages, cocoa and coffee, big move. Food oils, rather large move. Always with a delay, but money printing has proven to make things go up. In terms of metal, this is back in the 70s with the price of copper and the price of uranium did. So this is what metals did when you didn't have electronic vehicles and you didn't have ESG mandates. That's what copper and uranium did. We can only imagine how high they're going to go next time. So we can give you a fundamental case on all these things, but we'll just do it for one and save the time. But uranium's had a nice move. It's gone from $20 to $50, but it was $136 once. This chart shows when it was $136, a lot of production came on. What we've seen in the last couple of years, when the price is bouncing between 20 and 50, a lot of production is shut down and nobody's announced the building of a new mine. The fundamentals look really compelling, even if they never build another reactor, and you probably watched the news, all of a sudden everybody wants to build new reactors. So the supply demand for uranium is still very, very compelling, and some of the stocks are still bargains. That's the chart we show every time, and it's in line with the optionality things where even if it takes a year or 5 years or 10 years for these optionalities to play, if things only double and it takes 5 years, that's 15% a year. If it takes 10 years, that's over 7% per year. We will let others have the surety of 1% in their 10-year bond. We prefer the optionality and patience model. Before concluding, though, you know, we are very excited about these value-laden, very high optionality prospects that aren't decaying, that should do well, but we still have roughly half the portfolio in more traditional value. The exact same sort of stocks that everybody else owns, but not in the places where everybody else owns them. So we love telecom services. People are going to continue to use them, but we can get way better bargains in Korea than we can in the U.S. People like a lot of good private equity sort of things, but Japanese equivalents, the trading companies are like merchant banks. Mitsui and Mitsubishi are two of the biggest, very strong companies with strong cash flow, railroads in Hong Kong, cheap, clean, carbon-free electricity, whether that's nuclear reactors in France or hydroelectricity generated electricity in Brazil or in Russia and so on. So the fact that these are so rich in cash flow and strong positions means that despite a lot of the portfolio being invested in these latent cash flows that we won't see for a few years, despite that, the entire portfolios trade at a low PE, 12 times, low price to book, 1 times, price to cash flow, 5.5 times. Even the dividend yield is much higher than the market's dividend yield. 3.5% is not so bad in this environment, and you get the upside for free. So we feel pretty good about that. And it's pretty equal in the global and international portfolios. The volatility, as we say, gives us a chance to, as we pointed out over the last couple of years, be buying emerging markets in the first quarter of last year, or selling them in the first quarter, buying them back in the second quarter. Same thing with gold. We were able to buy in March and sell in June. They ran up so much, and roll that into energy, copper and oil and gas, uranium. And then lately, as you can see off to the right, we've been selling some of the gas names and a lot of the uranium names because they've run up so much. But underneath this market that's hitting you today's another prime example, the indexes are up big, but last I looked, the advanced decline was negative. More stocks are down today in the U.S. than are up. In Japan, most stocks were down. I think all 33 sectors were down. So underneath this, there's opportunity for active managers to pick and choose. And we've been able to buy one of the better banks in the world, a dominant bank in Kazakhstan. We've been able to buy electric power in emerging markets. We've been able to buy Hutchinson, which conglomerate that owns good phone companies and ports and retailers, you name it. We've been able even to buy healthcare companies in Japan. So that's the sort of opportunities we like. Volatility is part of life, and they can suppress it for a while, but when they lose control, that is when active management can most excel. We started out talking about if there's ever a time to look different than the crowd, this is it. You can see that the crowd owns most of their money in one country, almost 60% of the portfolio is in one country, a country that's only a fifth of the world's GDP. In the past, that's always been a mistake. A dozen years ago, everybody said you must own the BRICS, you must own the emerging markets, that's where the growth is. They are right, that's where the growth's going to be, but they no longer like them. So we have a lot of money in emerging markets. We have a lot of money in Canada where they have so many of the scarce resources the world needs. So I look very different. Of course, have a lot more in energy. We've been selling a lot into this big run-up, but energy is something where a year ago people were told they could not own at any price. That's usually a buy signal. Materials, like I say, we've been able to rotate from one type of material to another, but still pretty undervalued. And off to the right, just to reiterate, this portfolio that is a value portfolio still owns the biggest and best. And the biggest holding now is the largest, lowest cost gas producer in the world. And we have some strong phone companies. We have the two best by far uranium producers in the world. Some of the better gold companies in the world, two of the three best hydroelectric franchises in the world, some great agriculture properties, and so on. So we like the way the portfolio is positioned, and as usual, we like to leave most of the time for questions and answers. So thank you.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, press star 1 to ask a question. We'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal for questions. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 at this time. Take our first question from Boris Palou.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, hi. I just have a question regarding your mutual fund. It's really exposed to the natural gas prices in the sense that you have a lot of companies that are in the natural gas field. And if you have high prices, it's really favored also uranium, and it feeds itself into higher fertilizers, so a higher inflation, so it's good for gold stocks. So how do you value natural gas, your natural gas exposure? You have an incentive price the same way you value uranium or gold stocks?
Yeah, no, that's a good question to talk about a lot of what we do. First of all, we take what the market gives us. So the main reason to own so much uranium and natural gas and gold is the market, especially a year ago, was giving it away. And historically, the first 20 years of my career really didn't own natural resources. They were overvalued. Off and on over the last 20 years, there's been good times to own base metals and then times to sell the base metals and own gold. When it comes to energy, we generally, over the last 15 years, haven't owned that much. But in 2016, we had a chance to buy things very cheaply, and we did. They ran up and we sold. Then we didn't do much until about 3 years ago. Natural gas started becoming very cheap, and we bought Range Petroleum. And then it became extremely cheap, so we bought as much Range as we could, and we bought Southwestern. And then on the oil side, we bought some of the higher cost Canadian ones because they had the most optionality, as we've just discussed. So we bought the high optionality companies and some of the better companies, we thought. And fortunately, that's worked out very well for us. But most of our energy has been uranium, and we've held that for a long time. And that shows the value of one of the slide shows patience. And the other, the incentive price that you've asked about that we'll get to. But this is a commodity that's been trading between $20 and $30, down from $136. We won't argue with some people that says it's worth $60. We won't argue with people that say it's worth $90. But 20 and 30 is wrong, just as 136 is wrong. So 136 supply came out of the woodwork. Kazakhstan went up tenfold. At the lower prices, all we've seen for the last half dozen years is mine after mine shutting, nobody building. And you've seen other ways to take the material off the market. It's underpriced. So we watch what people are doing, and we ask people what they're doing, and we ask what they think they're going to do. And we come up with an idea that 75 is a pretty good price. But like I said, we won't argue with $15 either way. And then we try to buy these things to where we're going to make a lot of money if we're right, and won't lose money if it stays at 30. Now it's moved, so it's good. So we try to buy where we don't lose money based on low prices. We make a lot of money on incentive price, equilibrium price. And then I mentioned Richard Cantillon, the idea that inflation will migrate through the system. Maybe the doubling of the money supply means 75 is going to prove to be too low. Lisa mentioned non-decaying options if we can buy these companies. So they're undervalued. If we're wrong on prices going up, they're undervalued if prices go to 75, and they're have massive upside if really the new price is 100 something. And so that's how we do it. We want the free optionality, the non-decaying options. So 75 is sort of a equilibrium incentive price for uranium. By coincidence, we view oil as right around the same, around 75, unadjusted for inflation. Natural gas, it's been 325 to 350 unadjusted for inflation. And so we've liked doing it that way. Gold, we've been using 2000 as a sort of supply and demand price unadjusted for inflation. There more than ever, inflation adjusting probably makes sense. So if we can buy gold companies that will make money if the price stays at 1700 will make us good money when the price gets to 2000 plus. And if it doesn't get there, you you're going to see existing mines deplete and not be replaced. And then, if people are correct when they point out to us, this isn't a commodity, you can't eat it, and you can't put it in the gas tank, you don't burn it, you don't consume it, it looks more like money. We don't eat dollars, and we don't put euros in the gas tank and whatnot, and so maybe you should view gold as more of a supply-demand versus dollars. And yeah, the money supply has gone from 400 per ounce to 22,000 per ounce, so we're not suggesting that's going to happen. We're just suggesting, once again, there's a reason we're testing everybody's patience with optionality. If we can buy these things to where they don't decay, we make money at 1,700, we make money at 2,000, and we make a lot of money if the real number's 3,000 or 4,000. That's what we're looking for. So 2,000 for gold, 75 for uranium. Copper's been 3-something. Natural gas in the mid-3s, oil 75, and then adjusted for inflation, they're all higher than that.
Thank you. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. We'll take our next question from Bruce James of James Reservoir Incorporated.
Yeah, what is your take on investing in copper? Because I noticed you invest in Turquoise Hill Resources, which I assume is kind of like your long-term option. You don't seem to really invest too much in active producing copper mines. Is that correct?
We have two main copper companies, Ivanhoe and Turquoise Hill. As you pointed out, copper has had a tremendous run, and as Dave mentioned, we like when the commodities are below its incentive price. Now copper is starting to reach that incentive price, especially adjusted after inflation. However, the mining companies are still at a significant discount. And I think the biggest reason for that is that the copper companies that we own have huge resources. So when you take time into consideration, any production after 10 years is really not counted in many of the models the analysts come up with. In addition, there's a huge draw to developed markets and countries that are deemed less risky. Ivanhoe has one of the best copper mines in the world that they're developing in the DRC, a very risky place. Turquoise Hill is in Mongolia, and there's a lot of disagreements between the company and the country right now. So those are, unfortunately, risks that you can't get away from, but you can diversify. And so if you look at our portfolio, we own a lot of different mining companies because we want to diversify across geographies and assets and management teams and balance sheets, because there are so many things that can go wrong. And then in addition, we require a large margin of safety. So the incentive price is our anchor. However, there are times when even the commodity price can be high and still the mining companies are trading well below what we believe they should be worth.
Yeah, diversification is good. It's back to that concept of optionality. If where we're wrong, we lose 30, 40, 50%, and where we're right, we make 500% or more, and that's been the case. It makes for an attractive portfolio. Also, what people perceive as risky and what turns out to be risky is interesting. I think if you asked anybody 2 years ago, which is safe, Chile or the DRC, everybody would say, oh, Chile, that's where you want to own copper mines. And that's been a big problem for people in Chile. Meanwhile, the DRC and we both went out and spent time on the mine site. The country loved it. The people loved it. The local people were welcoming it. And the country's done so much to also build schools there and build gardens there and give people jobs and done a really good job, and that's been one of our better performing stocks, the one that seemed riskiest to people. The Turquoise Hill, the problem thus far doesn't even seem that much to be Mongolia, as Rio Tinto, a good quality company, but they've had problems building the mine correctly, and that has cost to run up for Mongolia, and so that needs to be sorted out. But all along, we've assumed that, one, there's massive value there, and two, we're going to get some haircuts and dilution as these problems work out, and both are been true. There's massive value, even more so now that the price of copper's run up. But there's issues that have been and still need to be worked out. When it's all said and done, we expect dilution, and we expect tremendous upside from here to that diluted price.
Thank you. We'll take our next question from Larry Klein of FSC Securities.
Yeah, thank you for the call today. With inflation being discussed so much in the markets, why do you believe the price of gold has stayed low?
History kind of suggests that when they print a bunch of money, they often use that money to buy bonds and things like that, and that makes the bond market go up, and that makes the stock market go up, and the art market and the real estate market. And when people are having fun making a lot of money and a mania, they have no use for gold. Gold's boring. Gold just sits there and holds its value. And who wants to hold their value when making money is really easy? But history also shows that eventually manias lose their zest and the money goes looking for safety. That's usually when the price of gold goes up. We show those other charts. Money's been printed, and gold's had long periods. It's been 1971 when we defaulted on the dollar, broke the supply to gold, and printed all that money. The price of gold immediately shot up, and then it fell. It had a two-year period where it fell from 300 to 200. And then 5 years later, it was 800. You saw a little bit of that in 2008 when things broke down. Gold fell 10%, and then it skyrocketed. You've got a year and a half ago when they announced that they were going to go insane with the money, where gold instantly shot up because people were afraid of what they're calling risk assets. We're going into a depression. Sell stocks and sell copper and sell everything else. But now it's become clear you can make a lot of money owning stocks and copper and uranium and oil. Who the heck wants to own gold? So we know nothing of the timing. We do know that gold tends to go up when everything else is faltering. So they have doubled the money supply. The price of gold seems assuredly will go up 50 to 100% at some point. We just don't know when. I'm not going to try to predict when, but we like the math.
Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. We'll take our next question from Ed Tompkins of Bozeman Financial Advisors.
Hello, Dave, and again, thanks for the call. Was just curious whether you're still carrying any short positions or put contracts on, I think it was the S&P.
And we don't short stocks, but we do look for mispriced securities. And so about 5 years ago, for the only time in my 40-year career, the implied vol got ridiculous on put options, and we thought that was a weird aberration at a time when the market was the most expensive ever. So we took advantage of that. The bad news is the market went from long-term bull market that was way overvalued to the longest ever bull market that was obscenely overvalued. So that was an unfortunate thing. The good news is we were right about two things. They were undervalued, and cycles haven't disappeared. And so in March of 2000, in several weeks' time, we made back 3 years' worth of losses and then some. And so it turned out to be a reasonable strategy and actually especially helpful because we had cash to invest at the bottom. We didn't figure we would ever get a chance to get in there again. But about 3 months ago, things got really cheap again. So we bought little 50 basis point positions for a couple months. Then the implied vol ran up and we stopped. This week it went back down, and so we have a 50 basis point position. So we're not going to predict when the market drops, but when the implied vol is too low, we will keep rolling these 50 basis point positions. We'll stop doing that when we make money or when, as last month, that becomes more expensive than we want to pay.
Thank you. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. We have no further questions in queue at this time. I'd like to turn the call back to Dave Ivan. Please go ahead.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for turning in. We do view that this is a time where everybody needs to think about what worked before the 40 years worth of falling interest rates and what's worked when money supply was going crazy around the world. We're pretty excited if the things that worked best then are the things that are most affordable right now. So feeling good. We can check in again in 3 months and talk about how the fourth quarter went. But we appreciate everybody's partnership, and we'll talk to you soon. Thank you.
This concludes today's call. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.